It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, February 3rd, 1975, and this is Dialogue Conspiracy 182. I want to repeat for people who listened last week the announcement, the address of Safer California, the bulletin that is out by the Criminal Justice Planning Department. I received some telephone calls on that matter, and you may be interested in that address. Again, the bulletin editor is the Office of Criminal Justice Planning, 7171 Bowling Drive, Sacramento, California, 95823. That is for the monthly bulletin that comes out on the Criminal Justice Planning for California. And you ask for the book on the standards and for the monthly publication that comes. And preferably ask for your publications to go back to October 74, Volume 7, Issue 8 of October 1974. The local area office is Region M for the Criminal Justice Planning is 700 Cass Street, Monterey, California. That's Suite A, 93940 is the zip code. Ask for the roster of members from your community and any minutes of meetings or planned meetings so that you can attend and make your voice heard on Project Safer California. This project that I discussed last week, that is a blueprint for many fascist ideas that we ran down, as I say, last week, fits very much in with the opinions of Mr. Edward Levy, who's been nominated now for the Attorney General of the United States. If you remember last week, I read part of the minutes of a meeting that was in Sacramento, where they were instructing various persons that if you don't accept these standards in your state, the wording went something to the effect that you'll get a mandate anyway. So it makes it look like it comes from the state. The opinion of the standards of justice in the states are actually laid down by the military and go by a military manual. And we'll talk about Edward Levy a little later if I have some time, the new nominee for the Attorney General. But his philosophy fits right into the standards, and this is something that we have to watch right now. Many books and articles are coming out, exposés of electronic surveillance, data banks, bugging, telephone conversations, keeping track of various riders, the Internal Revenue, working with the Justice Department and the CIA. All of these exposures are things which I've had in my files of research for the last years. I started the work on the John Kennedy assassination investigation, then went in to the people who killed him and what they were doing after he was murdered. And now in 1975, these exposures are coming. But let's not wait so long to stop the repressive action of certain intelligence and espionage agents. Step in now, and Safer California is a good place to start to protect your liberty. So let's do something about that right now. Well, this week is the first anniversary since the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. I call it the last big brahu of Mr. William Colby and the Central Intelligence Agency. I believe that this was planned much earlier than 1972 and went into effect 1974. It seems that the best thing the CIA could do at this time, the safest thing probably, would be to have killed or to kill Emmeline William Harris and Patricia Hearst. I have no idea where they are, but I imagine to those who are part of this giant conspiracy, they have to be about as expendable as White House tapes. I've talked before about U.S. Envoy John Patterson, who was murdered in Mexico in March 1974, following the Hearst kidnapping, because there was a long rash of them that were done by government agents. And a Bobby Joe Kesey has been charged with this kidnapping murder. He's from the Central Intelligence Agency. This Kesey trial has been called off. That was March, and this is now February, but his trial is called off, and they're stalling this one out. And a lot hinges on these individual trials, which are shelved. But the way that he was murdered could happen or has happened to the Harrises and Patty Hearst. I can't believe that they would be found alive someday because the conspiracy and the plot was so thick it would be easier to have them silenced. FBI agent Charles Bates said on the first anniversary of the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst that the Harrises and Patty Hearst are no more wanted. They're no longer wanted on the FBI list, the most wanted list. They've been taken off of that. For whatever reason, I don't know, but they're off that list. The investigation of the SLA cost the taxpayers between $4 to $5 million. We'll go into the Senate ruling or the vote this week that the Senate would investigate the FBI and the CIA for the past 20 years for their domestic activity, and they have a budget of $750,000. But the Hearst kidnapping investigation ran into $4 to $5 million, and the entire investigation was to cover up the links of the Department of Corrections to the military, to the CIA, and all the important persons were not apprehended, investigated, or followed through. Mr. Pecunier, Raymond Pecunier, the Department of Corrections chief in California, resigned recently, and I can't help but wonder if his early retirement at age, I believe, at 61, wasn't because of the bungling of the SLA. Donald DeFries was a captive at Vacaville, where he was introduced to Colston Westbrook of the CIA, and I can't help, as I say, to feel that there was a link between his being removed from that position probably before it ever could be investigated, just like Richard Helms was taken quickly out of the CIA before these new investigations were to take place. There are lots of loose ends in the Hearst case. I'm not going to do a whole show on it tonight. Patty Hearst was last seen May 15th at the apartment of Mrs. Alcala in Hollywood in the company of two black men. For example, the inconsistencies of the open questions, I'd like to give three examples of a messy case in the collusion of the investigative agencies. How come the police never put out a description of the two black men that were with Patricia Hearst the very last night that she was seen? From that day forward, the FBI, the Los Angeles Police Department, the District Attorney Bush in Los Angeles, the District Attorney Browning in San Francisco have only wanted the Harrises and Patty Hearst. And how come Ed Davis, Chief of Police of the Los Angeles Police Department, is so concerned about black radicals at this point that they let them go and don't even care if they're arrested and aren't charged for allegedly assaulting or threatening Mrs. Alcala? And how do we know that the woman with the two black men was Patty Hearst, or that Mrs. Alcala would know the difference? Another example of the sloppy work is the two black men were with a female when Patty Hearst was kidnapped a year ago, and from the moment that Sin Q, Donald DeFries, surfaced on the radio and television with his tapes, the FBI and the San Francisco police, Oakland police, never looked for the second black man. There's nobody in the case open for kidnapping Patty Hearst, and the subject was dropped entirely for the night she was kidnapped. And knowing the racism of the police department and the FBI in getting a legitimate black radicals, the Black Panthers, the Black Muslims, the Black Liberation, it's just amazing that they wouldn't want the black men that took Patricia Hearst or the two that were in Hollywood the last night she was seen. Another point is that Donald DeFries had a double, a Mr. Keaton, who was living with a family that DeFries lived with in Buffalo in the spring of 73. He was living with that family. DeFries had escaped, in quotes, escaped Soledad, had walked out with the help of some guards. And the FBI, when they learned that there was this double, said, well, he isn't wanted for any criminal charge. He didn't commit a crime. Well, that isn't the point of the case. If DeFries was being impersonated, he didn't have two men with him in Vacaville or two in Soledad prison. And where did this other man, was it in Los Angeles, or where was this other man with DeFries that he knew, his family that he lived with, knew about them in the early years of his childhood, was an identical dead ringer? Where is this Mr. Keaton, and how come the FBI doesn't want him? Because in every major conspiracy, such as the John Kennedy assassination, or Robert Kennedy's murder, or Martin Luther King's, Oswald had doubles, Sirhan double, and James Ray, the alleged assassins, had doubles. This is a common pattern of the espionage establishment. The entire SLA is so filled with questions that it only can be answered if you assume that those people were infiltrated and directed by the military intelligence with the help of the California Department of Corrections and the FBI. So the FBI wants to cool things off, and she's no longer, they are no longer on the most wanted list. Even Catherine Hurst, the mother of Patricia Hurst, said that she would just as soon have her daughter home even if she were Jane Fonda. About 5 months ago, she said she'd rather have her dead than red. If she were a legitimate radical, it would be easier to have her dead. Now her mother has changed her story and says if Patty comes home, we'll deprogram her. And I'm sure that Ted Patrick, the great deprogrammer who just got off some criminal charges on another case, is waiting for his big assignment to deprogram Patty Hearst. The Senate voted 82-5 this week to probe the CIA and the FBI. 82-5. This is a quotation from the committee: a full investigation of alleged illegal spying on civilians and charges of related abuses of power by the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI and other agencies. And as I say, they have a budget of $750,000, and it would take that much to look into one example of the Central Intelligence Agency working domestically, for example, Marina Oswald. Frank Church, Democrat of Ohio, will head the committee with Philip Hart. The intelligence community is spending $1 billion a year. The CIA spends $750 million a year. And this committee is going to spend $750,000 to find out how they're spending their $1 billion. Now, that is so ridiculous, but I thought that I would bring it up. Mike Mansfield, the majority leader from Montana, said there will be no whitewash in this inquiry, nor is there room for vendetta against the CIA or FBI. The inquiry will investigate the abuses of power and find out ways to forestall future abuses. Now, I have a suggestion to those of you who are listening to Dialogue Conspiracy for the first time, or for those of you who have listened for 3.5 years or picked it up in any interim in between. Some of you have taken notes of what I've said. Some of you have taped cassettes of past programs. Why don't you bombard the committee with leads? You can write to Frank Church, Democrat of Idaho, or Philip Hart, and bring up any one subject or some of the subjects that I've talked about on Dialogue Conspiracy. And this is your chance to prove whether some of the allegations I've been making are true or false, or to see if Congress is sincere. We've heard this saying, there can be no whitewash, so let's send them some suggestions of areas that can be documented or leads that are important and see what they do about investigating these matters. I've run these men through the years, so I don't have too much confidence that they're going to hit the major points, but maybe when they get started, they'll need more money and it'll be allocated to them. An example of the CIA working domestically is brought to mind in the story of E. Howard Hunt. I talk about him on many, many programs ever since the first arrest at the Watergate. But I want to run down today about 7 points of E. Howard Hunt, and I'll go fairly slowly because maybe you can jot some notes on these. As long as the committees are working back there and you follow my reasoning, the hypothesis, you can write an intelligent letter to this committee and say, will you please get in touch with Mae Brussel, or what about E. Howard Hunt in this position, or support Congressman Gonzalez to open up the Kennedy assassination in lieu of this evidence. I'll read you a news bulletin last week from Congressman Gonzalez, and previously he was asking for an opening up of the CIA based upon the new Watergate exposures and existing evidence on the conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. But I want to read you a few things about E. Howard Hunt that would fit into the investigation of the CIA taking place in Washington, because it does link also to the Watergate, so they've got a double barrel thing going there. Some of this, these things I have mentioned on various programs, but I'm going to list them now and see how you can help put your head in the direction that I'm going with E. Howard Hunt. We have mentioned before that E. Howard Hunt was the man that gave Richard Nixon the most trouble the minute the men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel. It was in June, 3 days later, they were worrying about E. Howard Hunt because they said it would go back to the Bay of Pigs. That's the White House tapes. They said it would go back to the Bay of Pigs. the March 23rd meeting, 1973, in the White House, they were talking again about E. Howard Hunt because he was about to be sentenced and he wanted $1 million for silence. And Richard Nixon was talking with John Dean about E. Howard Hunt. Well, one point I want to make it came out in the New York Times this last week, was that E. Howard Hunt was the chief of covert action for CIA Domestic Operations Division, that's the DOD, that's that secret organization in the White House, from 1962 to 1966. You can write down these dates, 1962 to 1966. Hunt was the chief of covert action, that is the dark espionage secret activities for the CIA Domestic Operations Division inside the United States. And this was from 1962 to 66. This information came out in many sources in the last week. One of them was the New York Times, January the 15th. And Mr. Colby was giving this testimony at his hearings before the Congress, the committees. Also, the second point is that E. Howard Hunt was acting station chief in Mexico City during August and September of 1963. Now, if he was domestic operator chief in 62 to 66, part of his domestic work in the United States took him to Mexico City for two brief months. From August to September in 1963, he held two jobs. One was acting station chief for the CIA in Mexico City during August and September of 1963, when all the important operatives involved in the John Kennedy assassination were in Mexico City. For 2 months as Domestic Operations Division chief, he spent those 2 months in Mexico. And the 2 months he was in Mexico, Clay Shaw was there, the man that Jim Garrison arrested in New Orleans for conspiring to in the John Kennedy assassination. And Victor Marchetti has mentioned Clay Shaw was in the CIA the same time that Garrison was talking about. David Ferry was down there in Mexico, another CIA man that Marchetti has revealed and Jim Garrison said was CIA. And Breck Wall and a team of eight men, Emilio Santana, a group of eight men or 10 people were in Mexico, including Albert Osborne that I've mentioned on programs, whose alias is John Howard Bowen, the man who heads the School for Assassins for the CIA and FBI in Mexico, and accompanied Oswald to Mexico in September 26, 1963. E. Howard Hunt was the chief of domestic operation divisions in the United States from 62 to 66, working with Cubans from the Bay of Pigs operation, and he also was acting station chief in Mexico for 2 months, holding two jobs. Now, E. Howard Hunt, during 1962, this is the same period, 62 to 66, was a ghostwriter for Alan Dulles, who was soon to become a member of the Warren Commission when John Kennedy was killed a short while later. We have it's factual information. E. Howard Hunt helped him write his book on espionage. He was a ghost writer, prolific writer in fiction books, but a ghost writer for Alan Dulles, the chief of all United States intelligence, and framed the whole Cold War and the CIA. The OSS became the CIA. Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA, and his author was E. Howard Hunt at the same time that Hunt was down in Mexico where these assassins were and the people that worked with the assassins, and Hunt was also the station chief. He was working in the United States in the Domestic Operations Division. The fourth point is that one of Hunt's jobs as a Domestic Operations Division CIA agent in 1962, in this period from 62 to 66, was working for a publishing company that published 15 to 16 books at the suggestion of the CIA. It's called the Prager Publishing Corporation in New York, and their offices are the Continental Press and the National Press Building in Washington, D.C. And one of Hunt's jobs was working for this book publisher for the CIA, Prager Publishing Corporation. The fifth point I want to make that I've talked about on Dialogue Conspiracy is that I have minutes of the meetings of the Warren Commission, about six meetings that were declassified in the National Archives, and at the very first meeting of the Warren Commission, Alan Dulles came to the Warren Commission with a book. And he said, "Gentlemen, I have a book on past assassins that I've studied. It's a profile of their personalities, of previous assassinations. It would be a guideline to study Lee Harvey Oswald." Now, I was suspicious of this book. He apologized to members of the commission. He said, "I only have paperbacks." And he gave each one of the members of the Warren Commission a book on past assassinations. And when I did my research on Lee Harvey Oswald, I realized that none of the adjectives or characteristics of Lee Harvey Oswald, the actual Oswald, fit the Warren Report description, and I wondered where this garbage was coming from. So I wrote to John J. McCloy of the Warren Commission and asked what the name of the book was that was brought to them by Alan Dulles at the first meeting, and he wrote me back a letter and said he never received such a book. And I wrote to Senator Cooper and asked for the name of the book that the Warren Commission received, and he said he never received such a book. Now, here I had the minutes of the meetings where they all attended the meeting, was handed to them. I wrote to Lee J. Rankin, the head attorney for the Warren Commission. He didn't answer. I wrote to Gerald Ford on the Warren Commission, and he didn't answer. Every member that I wrote to that answered me didn't said there was no such book. They never heard of it. I wrote to the archives and inquired about such a book, and they didn't know where it existed. So now some investigative work has to be done by people who hear the show, who are out in the field, to help me find the book that was brought to the Warren Commission by Alan Dulles when they met to do their work, and let's find out if that book was written by E. Howard Hunt. I've mentioned the book in this episode many times on KLRB, but not in conjunction with Hunt being the ghostwriter for Alan Dulles or being the head of the Domestic Operations Division from 1962, which was 1 year before John Kennedy was killed. Now, Hunt also, the sixth point is that Hunt was familiar with political assassinations. The investigation of the Watergate so far has brought up his links to the plans to kill Castro, and also the plans in 1971 were going to be done down through Latin America to kill the president of Panama. This was one of the assignments of Hunt and Liddy. So Hunt is not unknown to assassination teams, and this very closely links to a possible role which he would have in the Kennedy assassination. Now the question if Hunt's job was chief of covert action from 62 to 66, and 2 months of it was spent with people involved in the Kennedy assassination, and he's writing for Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA until Kennedy removed him, how much more evidence does the Congress need before they investigate every aspect of E. Howard Hunt and the Kennedy assassination? And then, to add one more factor to this, there's a book called Were We Controlled, written by a man with a pseudonym, Lincoln Lawrence, who worked in the Pentagon. And Lincoln Lawrence knew that a man high up in military intelligence had written a book. And with his mind, three men from the intelligence system had written a small book which was supposed to be very short, 58 pages in length, and it was supposed to be a diabolical plot to kill President Kennedy, three men. Now you have to remember that E. Howard Hunt also is a prolific fiction writer who's written approximately 45 books while employed by the CIA. He pushes out this pulp and novels. So not only was he writing for Alan Dulles on espionage, but he had the mind to create these mystery stories and could create a diabolical plot to kill JFK. I'm not saying he did it, but a member of the Pentagon heard that high up in military intelligence and the espionage system, three men concocted a diabolical plot to kill JFK. And as I say, it was supposed to be 58 pages in long, and it was supposed to be circulating in Chicago. Now that would fit in with the Chicago plans to kill John Kennedy. He was supposed to be killed at a football game in November, which was be called off because of the Diem murder in South Vietnam. Abraham Bolden, the Secret Service man from Chicago, went to Washington to the Warren Commission and tried to tell them of the plot to kill Kennedy in Chicago, and he was put into a prison for 6 years and locked up because of his wanting to reveal the plans to kill Kennedy in Chicago. So the links of the Chicago, the book floating around Chicago, what could have been the blueprint for the murder or the murders that were going to participate. Now, the author of this book, when it was found by Lincoln Lawrence, and he spent 3 years looking for it, was David Warren. It was called an explosive documentary novel that would blow the lid off the secrecy surrounding the facts of the John Kennedy assassination. And at the time of the Watergate, when the Watergate story broke, E. Howard Hunt had three aliases, and one was Warren, Edward Lee Warren. But 1963 was the time of the assassination of Kennedy. In 1963, Hunt was working domestically for the CIA and with the Cubans from the Bay of Pigs. And Watergate came along 10 years later, and he was using the name Warren as an alias, a different first name, but he was using the name Warren. So I just wonder how much more, as I say, there's a lot more about E. Howard Hunt and the Young Americans for Freedom I talked about last week, but the evidence, it just seems to be piling up that the Congress, Frank Church and Philip Hart and others, just better get and investigate what E. Howard Hunt was doing in the United States in those years, and did it pertain to Oswald, David Ferry, Clay Shaw, Albert Osborne, and all the people involved that were in Mexico that went to Dealey Plaza the day Kennedy was killed shortly afterwards. As I say, Texas Congressman Henry Gonzalez asked last week, this is the news release, in light of certain CIA revelations, he's pressing for a congressional probe into the John Kennedy assassination. He's been pushing for a new investigation into this assassination ever since Watergate scandal surfaced 2.5 years ago. The congressman argued if the White House could cover its own and the CIA's involvement in Watergate, the similar cover-up could have been behind the probe in the JFK murder. Watergate burglar E. Howard Hunt revealed recently the CIA formed that domestic operations division a year before Kennedy's murder. According to Hunt, that domestic operation division was a secret unit operating within the United States composed almost entirely of CIA-trained Bay of Pigs veterans. Many members of the Bay of Pigs team were critical of Kennedy prior to the assassination because JFK refused to supply air cover during the invasion and because of his refusal to approve other CIA-backed attempts to overthrow Fidel Castro by force. And another thing that came over the news service, I believe I mentioned it last week, is that the Senate is investigating the fact that Bernard Fensterwald, the attorney currently for James McCord, who is co-founder of the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, has been followed by the CIA, also monitored by the CIA. That was exposed this last week. Well, E. Howard Hunt is terribly important. I did start to read a list of hypotheses of his activity in relation to Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford from Computers and People, the January issue of 1975, and maybe we'll run down a few more of those this week, but there is some current news that I did want to cover before I got back to Nixon, Ford, and E. Howard Hunt. I also want to remind listeners, last week I talked about the Vesco allegations that the CIA, the same CIA that killed Kennedy and got Richard Nixon out of office, were trying to get Vesco back into the United States. And I talked about the different forces that had trapped Nixon. If they didn't murder him, they trapped him. And American Opinion came today, as a matter of fact, I just received my February 1975 American Opinion, which is from the John Birch Society. And very often, their literature is exactly into my way of thinking as much as any radical or leftist. A lot of people think because I'm doing this work, you have to be very far left to be doing this research, but that isn't true at all. I take the American Opinion and a lot of other literature of this type to read what information they have. And there's an article in there by Susan L. Huck. It's called The Tape Chase, Who Controlled the Nixon Tapes? And she's talking about the coup d'etat in Washington, the Watergate coup. She calls it the Watergate coup, and how Richard Nixon was forced to have these tapes. And I mentioned last week that Mr. Wong of the Secret Service, and she mentions Mr. Wong of the Technical Service Division. That's the super secret group that worked with Alex Butterfield. Butterfield came on in time for Richard Nixon in the White House to be taped. And this article has a very interesting section on the keeping the control of Richard Nixon through those tapes, and the moving in of Mr. Haig by Nelson Rockefeller. She talks about Al Haig, who retired from the Army just 6 days before Mr. Haldeman was out of the White House, and Mr. Butterfield had hold of the vault of the tapes, and Haig got into the vault. He got the key to the vault. And this is from the article, quote, it says, "Perfectly obvious that the subpoenas written for the tapes were by persons who already possessed a most detailed familiarity with what was on the tapes. And how would they know unless the man with the key to the vault made them available?" Now, the man with the key to the vault, she said, was General Haig. Nixon had promoted Haig over 240 more generals and put the star on him, the general star on his shoulder. It's interesting to know that Haig was Rockefeller's man, and Kissinger brought Haig along, and everybody knows it. She said there's a lot of play-acting involved in the Watergate thing. As Nixon finally figured out he was hopelessly boxed in, if he didn't resign, something worse was likely to happen, and his trusty chief of staff with the key was in regular communication with Mr. Kissinger and Defense Secretary Schlesinger to make sure Nixon didn't try anything. And then she goes on to say the man who inherited it, all of this, was nominee Nelson Rockefeller. There's a Rube Goldberg cartoon in American Opinion this month. It shows the 25th Amendment, and then it reaches over and it says the resignation of Agnew. Then something falls down and hits Rockefeller's resignation as government. Then it hits a cat that falls down on a shoe, and you've got the resignation of Nixon. And then you have Ford becomes president, and Ford appoints the vice president Rockefeller, and then the movement of Rockefeller into the presidency. This chain of command is pretty detailed, and it has the different rooms that were bugged and the belief of the American opinion that Nixon was shoved out of office and manipulated by these tapes. When you take one piece of evidence after another and line them up, it's overwhelmingly, again, obvious and evident that Nixon was shoved, and he also controls a certain amount of power because he knows as much on the people in power as they know about him. A Time magazine came out this last week with a report that former President Nixon, and this is a good one, and the two Kennedy brothers, Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy, were followed and bugged for their extramarital affairs, and allegedly Mr. Nixon had liaison with a Chinese woman in Hong Kong before he ever became president, which reminds me that former President Eisenhower's mistress died just last week. She passed away, and just a few years ago, the truth came out about Franklin Roosevelt and his mistress and her living in the White House and sharing a room next to him in the White House. This article about the Kennedy brothers is of no surprise to me. In the light of my research, I often wondered why Robert Kennedy never investigated the murder of his brother. He was the Attorney General. But as I went into the Warren Commission hearings, the 26 volumes, and got further into my research in the Kennedy assassinations, I recognized a chain of command from Frank Capell, C-A-P-E-L-L. He's from Liberty Lobby. Frank Capell is from military intelligence. And his name comes up in the 26 volumes in the investigation of the death of John Kennedy that the Warren Commission put together of exhibits and witness testimony. And Frank Capell had direct links, you see, to J. Edgar Hoover, and he had information about the extramarital activities of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. And after John Kennedy was dead, Robert Kennedy aspired to become the President of the United States, and he chose silence on the matter of his brother's activities and his own, and hoped to run without this blackmail affecting him too much. But we all know the consequences of that. And I always felt that, I know Ted Kennedy was followed, and this has come out not only recently, but many, many months ago. And the FBI not only bugged many congressmen, but the people that were going to be moved high up to office that aspire to be president or important committees, they keep this evidence for years and years and then use it when it's most important to remove somebody out of office. The Chappaquiddick affair was just a drop in the basket, but the Kennedy brothers, because of their extramarital activities, were never able to fulfill a lot of things they wanted to accomplish. John Kennedy was murdered, and goodness knows how many things he would have wanted to do if other people didn't know about his private life. We don't know how much he was blackmailed along the way on that, but I do know that Robert Kennedy had to have be forced into silence. There's no other reason for his accepting the findings of the Warren Commission until he himself was murdered by the same people. Now, Mr. Colby, I want to change the subject and get back to just one tiny aspect of the CIA exposures which are coming out in the news, because they're just gushing out. If you take the Washington Post and the New York Times particularly, there's so much information about the illegal activities of the CIA that even Mr. Rockefeller had to get on television and admit that they were doing wrong. I'm sure they'll get the same kind of sentence that the Watergate people got, which is unindicted co-conspirators, but nevertheless, the information is pouring out in various forms, and that's a start. The tip of the iceberg is getting a little bit bigger every week. But William Colby, the director of the CIA, testified before the Senate January the 15th. This is one of the committees and part of his testimony, and he made a statement. This is in quotes. The agency conducted 3 domestic break-ins in 66, 67, and 71. And in each case, they involved the premises related to agents, employees, or ex-employees. Now, he justifies this like, look, we're not bothering you, America. We're not butting in your business. We're only bugging our own. And I call this the occupational hazard, that you can be copied or murdered. You can be wiretapped, be under surveillance, things stolen from you. It's just boys among boys. So the Senate, so they're like a bunch of dumb people, not with information on the purposes of the entries, but perfectly satisfied that 3 domestic break-ins only related to employees. So what's the big fuss? They weren't anti-war people, and they weren't the women's movement, and the Congress accepts that, except they don't ask why. Well, I'll tell you about one of those entries, because they admitted one of the entries was Hans Tufte, T-O-F-T-E, but then they dropped the subject. But Hans Tufte, it was a very valuable person who has dropped out of sight in some form or other. He hasn't been in the news at all. Maybe he'll step forward now. He was a man who fought Hitler, was proven to be anti-Nazi, worked with the Free French, was in the underground in Europe. I believe he's from Holland, and became part of our CIA when World War II was over. In 1966, August 1966, my files go back many years, but the August 3rd, 1966, there was an article about a CIA agent found in the middle of a controversy. Hans Tufte's home was robbed by $19,000. Jewels were stolen, and it turned out it was from another CIA man who came in the house and stole the jewels. Tufte had a home for sale in Maryland or Virginia, and his mother-in-law was watching the house. He was out one day, and real estate people, he had the house listed with a real estate agency, and while he didn't know it, the real estate firm arranged for another CIA employee by the name of Kenneth Slocum to enter that home to see the property. And Kenneth allegedly, after this visit with the CIA man, $19,000 were stolen. But that's not all that was stolen. During the conversation around the house, Slocum said he noticed classified documents belonging to the CIA on the desk of Tufte. Now, you know that when you show a house, and I've shown houses for sale, and you have an open house, particularly in a city of all those snoops, and this is one of the high-ranking agents of the CIA, you just don't leave classified documents belonging to the CIA on a table the day that the real estate's having open house. So Mr. Slocum must have carefully arranged to go through with the real estate dealer, go through the possessions of Hans Tufte, and to get vengeance for him for what he took. They must have had wind that something was coming, that Tufte had something there, in order to go through this elaborate plot. And they went into there and distracted the attention, as they say, of his mother-in-law. Now, what was Huff doing? The time in 1966 when this was happening, Tufte didn't believe that Richard Helms should be director of the CIA. You see, Richard Helms had been in Germany interviewing Adolf Hitler. He had worked with Alan Dulles hand in glove. A person not from the agency up to that point was heading the CIA, but Richard Helms was the first man inside the agency to become the head and have no controls. And Tough was a well-known and proven and loyal agent to the CIA. And he had opposed the appointment of Richard Helms as CIA director on grounds that no career man should get the top job. So I'm sure Tuft was marked for something at the time. Now, maybe he was trying to prove a point, because these are the documents that were taken. At the time, Tuft also complained in 1966 that the CIA was following his wife. She took a trip to Europe and France and England, Italy, Canada, and that they were following her everywhere around. But what he was exposing, and you can find some of this in San Francisco Chronicle, August 13, 1966. I have many articles on Tuft. He had information about the Bay of Pigs, which took place in 62, the Dominican Republic, the overthrow of the Dominican Republic by the CIA, the Vietnamese operations, and the Kennedy assassination that would embarrass the CIA. They were embarrassing issues for the CIA. And Hans Tuft may have been our first Daniel Ellsberg or Victor Marchetti or Fletcher Prouty or I think of Louis Tackwood. He might have been one of the first who was about to expose the CIA for their blunders in the Bay of Pigs, the Dominican Republic, the Vietnamese operation, and the Kennedy assassination. He fought for a free world after World War II, and here he was back into a fascist government taking over, and he recognized it, and he didn't want Richard Helms, director of the CIA. So Tuft's home was robbed, and he put an ad in, I don't know whether it was a Wall Street Journal, one of the well-known newspapers, asking for a used espionage agent, and nothing's been heard of Tuft, at least in the eight papers I take every day. I haven't heard of Tuft since that time. But these are important people. See, Colby can say, oh, we bugged a man in 66 because it was related to the agency. But that isn't the full story. It related to us. It related to our government. Our government lies, our government manipulation, the killing of a president, illegal bombing, secret armies over Vietnam. Tuft might have been doing a great service until he was robbed, and then maybe he was sufficiently frightened into silence, so he hasn't become a Fletcher Prouty or Victor Marchetti. But that's the story of one of the men. Goodness knows who the other two were. Maybe the scandal was even worse. Maybe they were part of the Kennedy assassination. We don't really know who the other two were bugged, if there were 200, because these men aren't telling the truth under sworn testimony anyway. But he did talk about Tuft. Well, in the last 2 minutes remaining here, I might mention a few words about nominee Edward Levy, L-E-V-I. This man is a perfect nominee in the ilk of Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford to become the new Attorney General. He believes in the death penalty as a deterrent effect. He had a quotation in the paper today when even our California Attorney General, Evel Younger, says he's not sure it is a deterrent effect. It's never been proven to be a deterrent effect, but old Levy is out for blood, and he says it is. Second point is that if he's behind the times on what the death penalty does, he was ahead of his times in wiretapping, because 20 years ago he was instrumental in having a jury wiretapped while they were going through their discussions on an important case, and he calls that a mistake. Levy made a mistake 20 years ago in wiretapping the jury. Also, he was involved in stolen goods from the Justice Department. This man, he had files from the Justice Department 30 years ago, and when they discovered two drawers in his files of these documents, they referred to him as the absent-minded professor. They were things that belonged to the Justice Department, and later the FBI said he didn't have any criminal actions involved. They were important papers, that classified documents that ended up in his files 30 years ago, which he says he just didn't know. They filled two drawers of his file, and that was 30 years ago. 20 years ago, he was bugging the jury. Today, he's for the death penalty. That's the profile of our new nominee. And what do you expect from his team, Mr. Levy? Well, I'll see you. Our time is up again this week. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. Take care. And if you have any questions on the program or subjects you want me to answer, write me a letter, and I'll bring them up and answer them on the air for you.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist May Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB FM in Carmel, California.